The real talk of this retreat, because last night was a bit tired, adjusted a bit. That's better. So I hope everyone had a good rest last night. And even though you may not have had a shower, the body is one thing, but the mind is something different. So this morning you can have a mental shower to make the mind nice and peaceful and clean. And just like we say that to have a clean body is because of your precepts, we have also our inner precepts. And the talk this morning is on a subject which I've called in previous similar talks, making good meditation karma. The idea of karma in Buddhism is a very, very strong, wonderful teaching. It shows that every effect has a cause. There's some reason why these things happen. And even with meditation, we can still apply the same scheme of things. If the mind is agitated, there's a reason for it to be agitated. If it's sleepy, there's a cause for sleepiness. And if it's very mindful and alert, there's a reason for that. And if it's bright and joyful, we know the reason for that as well. The nice, clear, mindful, joyful, happy states, we think that that's a good thing to have. It's the result of what must be good karma. We have bright, peaceful, joyful states. And understanding the cause of these beautiful, peaceful, serene meditation states is understanding what I've called good meditation karma. And basically, good meditation karma is three things: making peace, being kind, being gentle. Because the way the Buddha taught the law of karma, he said that Chedamahang Karmang Vadami, which you all know, in other words none of you know, well some of you may know, it's a very famous statement of the Buddha. He said that intention is what I call karma. It's the intention is the most important part of karma. And so with meditation karma, it's the intention, not so much what you're doing, but how you're doing it. That is what we call good meditation karma. So it's not whether you're sitting cross-legged or sitting on a chair or walking or laying down or eating. It's how you're doing it is most important, to make sure the intention is good. And it's not whether you're watching the breath or whether you're just doing present moment awareness or whether you are, you know, focusing on buddho or doing metta meditation. It's not so important what you're doing as how you are doing it, to make sure you're doing this with good meditation karma. And I mention this because too often when people meditate, they forget that this meditation is an act of karma, and that karma is based on right intention, and the right intention of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is intentions of letting things be, renunciation, what I call just making peace with things, being kind and being gentle. Those are the three right intentions. That first right intention of just renunciation, nekama sankappa, is letting go. We always have to remember to let go of the correct thing. And too often when people understand or start to begin to investigate Buddhism, and they start to meditate, sometimes they let go of the wrong things. Sometimes when you're meditating and your body is in pain, sometimes we say we should just endure that pain and let go of the desire to change our bodily posture. And so you force the body to sit still, even though you're getting in increasing states of agony. That's letting go of the wrong thing. And sometimes people already started to sneeze. If you are going to sneeze, please sneeze properly, get it all out in one go. Because if you try and hold it back, and you hold it back and hold it back and hold it back, it's what we call in meditation the volcano effect. When the thing gets plugged up, it's going to blow sooner or later, and the sooner the better. Because if it blows very late after you've restrained it too long, then you spray all the people in front of you, behind you, to the left and right, and that's very, very unhealthy. The same with coughing. I don't know how many times you've seen this happening. But people, thank you very much for that. It's nice to have special effects during my talk. But when people cough, too often they think, oh, if I cough now I'm going to disturb all these other meditators. I'm sure just about to get enlightened, and one cough and they're in trouble. One sneeze and you've blown it. Oh, come on, I used to sleep, that was a pun. She's got it in the end. One sneeze and you've blown it. So if you cough or sneeze, just go and do it. So what you're really trying to be letting go of in meditation is the controller. You're letting go of that thing which tries to stop the cough, which tries to stop the sneezing, which tries to make it be this way or make it be that way, rather than letting go and allowing these things to flow. It's the same with the aches and the pains in your body. Those pains in your body are there for a purpose. And they're telling you your body is in a bad position. They're telling you that sort of your back maybe not be properly supported. And so if you feel there's an ache and pain in the body, if you possibly can, do something about it. You know, if you do get sore legs or sore bottom or sore back, sit on a chair or sit on one of these stools which people have so generously donated. Or see if you can find some more cushions or pillows or whatever to sit on. Whatever it is, to be caring for your body. So you're letting go of this great controller inside of you, which thinks, yes, the only way to get meditation success is to sit cross-legged, full lotus, straight back, for 10 hours at a time. Sometimes people think like that, and they force their body, and all they're really doing is they are strengthening their ego, strengthening this thing inside of them, which wants to control and manipulate and exercise their will upon the world, which is not the way to become enlightened. The more you exercise the will, the stronger your sense of self will become. So instead, we learn to float with the body. In other words, by that I mean, if there is an ache in your knee, the body is telling you, please move me. So move. Move very gently and very mindfully, which usually means doing it slowly. And if you find during the meditation you have got an ache somewhere, you recognize that ache, and you recognize it's not just a small thing, but it's something which is probably going to get worse, then very gently move the body as mindfully as you possibly can. And as you move the body, you will find that now you're comfortable. And you haven't lost much of your peace. And having changed your posture, then you can proceed deeper into stillness because you are comfortable. The alternative is sitting there until the pain gets so great that that really disturbs your meditation. And you cannot relax the mind when the body is so tense with pain. So if you do have an ache or pain in the body, just flow with the body. Do what the body is asking you to. If you have an itch, it takes a second to scratch it and it's gone. If you've got an itch, you don't scratch it. You think, shouldn't I? Is it going to go away? And it lasts for minutes and minutes and minutes and disturbs the progress of your meditation. So be kind to the body, because what you're letting go of is the controller. And also, as I said last night, be kind to the surroundings. You cannot control the people around you. You cannot control the heat, the cold. You cannot control the atmosphere. You cannot control your food. There's so much in life you cannot control. And so you let it go. When you let things go, strange things happen. When you stop trying to control things, everything becomes very peaceful. We try and make things this way and that way to suit ourselves. We never find peace. But if we just float with the body, whatever the body wants, okay body, you want to be scratched, I'll scratch you. you'll find after a very short while the body settles down. When you don't try and control something, those people relax. Yesterday, just were running around, I had all the keys, and someone was, she's not here, mean. She was saying, oh yeah, we really didn't realize now you're not the spiritual director, you are the spiritual dictator. Because I've got the keys to everything in this place. And I was even joking about that camera over there. Because that camera, we can move it, we can zoom it. And when I'm not gone there, I can sit in this room and try and see everything you're doing. I can zoom in on you. And I thought, wow, this is real good dictator stuff. I can install one of these in each one of your rooms. But of course, you don't do things like that. Because a spiritual dictator, or any type of dictator, just wants to control people. And those of you who have been on my retreats before, you know that that's not my attitude at all. I'm not going to even ask you to get up at a certain time in the morning. I'm not going to say you have to wait up until a certain time. And by giving you this freedom to come and go whenever you wish, to be able to sit, to walk, to sleep, just to hang out in the bush, by giving you that sense of freedom, hopefully I'm teaching by example that I'm not going to control you in any way. And when I don't control as a teacher, hopefully you get the idea that you won't control your body either. Because if I was a control freak and said, sit up straight, stop moving, stop scratching, I saw you. And what would that do to you? You'd get so tense and tight, that you would have a lot of fear inside of you. And that tightness, that fear, which comes always from controlling, is again one of the opposites for what we're trying to attain. It's this beautiful, peaceful, still, gentle state of mind. Now I mentioned this as a simile, because are you the spiritual dictator of your meditation? Are you someone who's always got the zoom on your mind and trying to control this and caught yourself out for sleeping or thinking stupid thoughts? If you're a control freak of your mind, a dictator of your meditation, you'll find that your mind gets afraid, gets tense, will never be able to get this beautiful, peaceful relaxation which is necessary for meditation. So just the same way that I don't try and control you, please, you don't control your mind. You let it be. You give it a sense of freedom. What you're really doing is respecting your mind. Your relationship to your mind and your meditation should never be as a master to a slave or a mistress to their servant. Your mind is not your servant or slave. It is your friend. And if you look upon your mind with friendship, with respect, then the mind will relax and will want to be with you. It's the same way that if you have a very, very dear friend, you would never tell your friend, right, we're going to have a cup of coffee and you're going to have latte, no sugar and soy milk in it. It's good for your health. And then you're going to have no biscuits and you're going to talk to me about whatever it is for 10 minutes and after 10 minutes you have to go. Would you ever talk to a friend like that? If you have a friend, what do you usually do? You say, do you want a cup of coffee or a cup of tea? What do you want? Because you're kind and friendly to somebody, you give them a sense of freedom to be themselves. And you just enjoy them for who they are. And that way, your friends stay with you. And they usually stay and drink a cup of coffee much longer than usual, because they're enjoying your company. Now, hopefully you can understand the simile. If you have the same attitude towards your mind, this sense of friendliness and kindness, like your mind is a very dear old friend. You don't tell your friend, the mind, what to do. You ask it, what do you want? And you're kind to your mind. With that sort of attitude, your mind will stay with you for long periods of time. Not because you're controlling it and making it stay with you, because it likes you and wants to be with you. One of the biggest problems of a retreat is restlessness, the mind never staying with you, but going off into fantasies and dreams or sleep. Why does it do that? What's a karmic cause for a restless mind? And the karmic cause of a restless mind is because you lack that kindness and softness to the mind. You've been so cruel and so controlling and so much of a dictator to your own mind that as soon as your mind sees you coming, it runs away. It runs away anywhere, into the past, into the future, to fantasies or sleep, anywhere but to be with you, because you treated it so bad in the past. So treat your mind as a friend. If you treat your mind as a friend, not as a slave, not as a servant, then it will stay with you. And as it stays with you, because it's not running around elsewhere, then you experience the beautiful, peaceful states of meditation. It's a strange thing that, like many people, I always thought to be able to get into deep meditation, you had to control the mind. Force it, make it happen. And every time you did that, you just get this tightness of the mind. You could be reasonably still. You know, you can get the mind to sort of focus on something like the breath, but you couldn't take it deeper. It was like one of these mazes, which I remember used to go into as a boy. These mazes made out of hedges with little passages, and you had to find your way to the center. And sometimes you go down one passageway, turn left, turn right, and you think you're getting very close to the center, but you get so close, but you couldn't get to the very center, you had to go all the way back again. It seemed it was getting close, but you came across a dead end, and you could go no further. That's like people who control and use force in meditation. You can get deep, but you come across a barrier which you cannot force your way through, because you've gone on a wrong route. So you have to go all the way back again and start another route. The route of the Buddha, which was the route of letting go of desire, letting go of craving, going against the stream of control. When we understand that, we understand this idea of letting go is letting go of that thing inside of us which always wants to do the meditation, always wants to make things happen, always wants to say, today I'm going to sit for longer than I've ever sat meditation before. All of that stuff coming from a sense of ego and self, the controller, and that goes against the path of Buddhism. So we have to learn how to let go of the right thing, let go of controlling, which is why I say it's called making peace. The world is never perfect, as I was mentioning last night. You are not perfect, I am not perfect, your cushion's not perfect, the center's not perfect, this talk is not perfect. But we can always make peace with things. Making peace with things is letting go of this desire to change everything and to make it into this ideal meditator. We take away that idea of making things ideal. You can see where the ideal comes from. It's just an idea, that's all. So when we take away the concept of making things perfect and we just instead make peace with things, you find you can make peace with anything in this world. You can make peace with pain. Sometimes, even though you can scratch, you can move, sometimes in this retreat it might be a gut ache, it may be an inner itch or a cough or a cold or whatever. There are some physical feelings which, no matter what you do, you cannot get rid of. But you can always make peace with them. And it's a wonderful thing that once you know how to make peace with things, not to fight things, sometimes that pain completely disappears. For those of you who've read my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, you know one of those stories, and one of those true stories which about an experience which taught me what letting go was, and letting go of the right thing. And it was incredible to see the effect that had on me. That was the story of my toothache. Maybe 2 or 3 years after ordaining as a monk, in this monastery in Thailand, in those days there was no electricity in the monastery. There was no road going to it, only a dirt road. Now, of course, that monastery is famous, electricity, computers, you name it, good roads there, it's got it. But those early days, it was incredibly simple. And when I had a toothache, there's no way of phoning up for a dentist or going to see one. There was no telephone, no electricity. There wasn't even any aspirin or Panadol in the cabinet. No painkillers, nothing. So you just had to endure. And I remember that toothache in the evening. It got so bad. Literally, I couldn't stand it any longer. I know that sometimes people actually have told me, there's like loads of lot since then, that those infections can actually sometimes go to your brain and actually kill you, or at least drive you crazy. And actually toothaches or tooth infections can be, you know, much more than just a danger to your gums, but a danger to your brain as well. And maybe this was one of those toothaches, but it was literally driving me crazy. And even though I was a tough monk, I just could not stand that pain. And so what happened was, you try and meditate it away. And in those days, my meditation was watching your breath at all costs. No messing around. Sitting down, doesn't matter if your body hurts, forget about your body, just watch your breath go in and go out. And focus so strongly on the breath to try and blot out everything else. And a lot of times you could blot out the other feelings. Now, I've mentioned other stories about meditating in those forests without any mosquito calls, mosquito repellent, no nets, out in the jungle meditating and getting bitten alive by these mosquitoes. Literally 60, 70, 80 on you at one time. And I tried to force my mind onto the breath, and you could do that. You could watch your breath so perfectly you couldn't feel any other part of your body. So you could actually escape from the irritation of 60, 70 mosquitoes at a time. So I had willpower. But when it came to the toothache, my willpower was not enough. And hopefully, and I'm saying this seriously, hopefully that one day you'll come across such pain, which you cannot endure. Because you learn a huge lesson from that. Because when you can't endure it, you've only got one other option. Of course, I tried all the other options first of all, trying to blot the mind, blot the pain out with watching the breath. Then I tried walking meditation. And we have the walking meditation mats over there. I really love walking meditation. That's why the carpets we chose are red colour. It's red carpet treatment for your meditators. So I tried walking meditation, and usually, you know, you try and do walking meditation slowly, especially in the small halls there. You can only go slowly when you're walking meditation, otherwise you go so fast you have to decelerate before you hit the wall, and it gets too disturbing for you. If you want to do the fast walking, go outside where there's more space for you. But doing the slow walking in pain, you just could not walk slowly, because you can't do anything slowly when you're in agony. So I was not doing walking meditation, I was doing running meditation, trying to escape from the pain, and it didn't go away. So then I went up to my hut after trying sitting, walking. The next thing I tried was chanting. Remember, many of you know that I was a scientist before, a hard-nosed physicist. And I didn't believe in all that superstitious rubbish. Where's chanting? Now how can that work? But when you're desperate, you're willing to believe anything. So I started chanting, and of course it didn't work. What had happened, I changed my mind about chanting afterwards. I know much more about how the mind works and what goes on in this universe. But when I was chanting, I had to stop chanting, because in agony you were shouting those words. I couldn't chant softly. I could do nothing gently when you're in agony. And so this is why I said it'd be wonderful if ever you get to that experience of unbearable pain and all your options of escaping have been used up and nothing works. These wonderful occasions in life, because of this occasion you've only got one more choice. There's only one more thing to do, and that's to let go and stop trying to beat the pain. And when I did that, the very first moment, just not even a second, as soon as I stopped fighting that pain and let it go, it disappeared. completely vanished. It's one of those wonderful experiences to witness. Counterintuitive, completely unexpected. You said, okay, pain, I'm going to let go. Now, many of you, like me in those days, you'd heard those words, letting go. You know, it's one of the most important words in any spiritual path. Let go, let it be, make peace with things. You've heard it, but you haven't done it. And when you do it for the first time, you really just let go. You stop trying to control it, stop trying to make it different, stop trying to escape from it. And it disappears. It's an amazing experience. 1 minute you're in agony, you just can't stand even one more moment, and the next minute you're in such a deep peace, you're blissing out and crying out of happiness. And that's what happens. What is teaching you there? And what that taught me was the problem was this controller trying to make it disappear, trying to make it go away. And all I needed to do was just to relax and let that pain be. And then it disappeared. It was only later on when you started to learn Pali and started listening to, looking at the Buddha's teachings, you understand what it meant. The Buddha said there's two, he called them two arrows. The physical arrow and the mental arrow. So whenever you've got a pain, a suffering, physical suffering, you've got the physical arrow which pierces you, and you've got the mental arrow which comes along with it. The pain and the, I can't stand this, I don't want this, this is unfair, I can't last another minute with this agony. And that's the mental pain. And the Buddha said, and it's just, you can experience this for yourself, the major part of suffering is the mental arrow, the mental reaction to the physical suffering. And he didn't say how much more it is, but I would say it's 99.9% of suffering is the mental suffering. The physical pain is tiny compared to the mental reaction we have to pain. Which is why when you let go of the mental reaction, trying to get rid of it, trying to control it, trying to find some place where you can escape from it, when you let go of the mental part of suffering, and you just have the physical part, it's nothing. You can bear it with a smile and laugh at it. Because the mental part is the biggest thing. And what is that mental part? Controlling, not wanting, trying to escape. It's all doing something. So when you make peace with the pain, when you let it be, most of it, if not all of it, disappears. And that's what I discovered personally in that first experience of knowing how to let go of pain. That's physical pain. You've got audio pain as well. When people cough or they snore, I tried and organizing this retreat, one of the reasons why I gave everyone their own room is because people snore. And so hopefully that you're in your own room and there's solid bricks between you and the next person, and you might notice in the design we're trying to put between the bedrooms like the en-suites. So most of you have got in your room to the next room there's two bathrooms between you. So if you've been woken up by snoring, there must be a champion snorer in the next room to you. But nevertheless, there will still be people banging doors or sort of doing some disturbing noise. That's the audio pain. Now with audio pain, like physical pain, there's two parts of it. There's the audio part and there's the mental part. And the mental part is 99.9% of the suffering. That stupid person. I'm going to ask Ajahn Brahm the next retreat, please, 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 I'm not going to be in the same cottage as them. Not even the same level. Whatever cottage they're in, please put me in the furthest one from them. That's like the audio pain. Remember, 99.9% of the pain is the mental part. So if we just let it be. If people want to make a noise, let it be. Don't control it. You can't control your neighbours. So just leave them alone. That's what I said last night. It's not the noise disturbs you. You disturb the noise. Even smells. I don't know what you had for breakfast, but I had some baked beans for breakfast. That's why I sit pointing this way. There's always going to be some smells about, because that's people, they do smell. We have these phenomena which are, and if they're not them, it's something else smells. But again, it's just a smell, that's all. Now, even dogs like it, they come up to you and they wag the tail, it's amazing. So you just let it be and just allow it to happen. And with all of these senses, you find out that you can make peace with anything. I mentioned sort of the sounds and the physical feelings because they're the two most difficult things to deal with on a retreat. But remember, the most important part is the mental part, which is why you can let things be. You can make peace with them. And instead of using the words letting go and letting things be or renunciation, some of those words have actually, they've been used so much they haven't got any power anymore. So these days, I call this act of renunciation making peace with things. Because you're renouncing the controller, the doer, the thing which wants to change things. So when I call it making peace with things, I'm focusing on exactly what you're letting go of. What you're renouncing. The controller inside of you. And also, by calling it making peace, it becomes quite obvious what the goal of this intention attitude is. How can you have peace if you don't make peace? So we make peace with every moment. And just like this retreat center started work about 15 months ago. And of course, you know, being the monks have been here all the time. They haven't actually been on site, coming over on the weekend, seeing how things are going. You can see just how this retreat center, so many little actions, so many millions of little digging the earth or just laying the concrete, thousands of millions of individual actions have made this beautiful retreat center. If you're going to make peace, if you're going to have peace, it takes many thousands of individual moments of peacemaking. And those moments of peacemaking are what you're doing right now. In this moment, and the next moment, and when you're meditating later on today, what are you doing? Are you making peace, or are you making war? There's only those two choices. Making peace means you're letting things be. You're making peace with the cold you have. You're making peace, you know, with the body which is aching. You're making peace with the tiredness. You're making peace with maybe being bored, I don't know. You're making peace with things. And that's something you can always do in every moment. And if you make peace with every moment, this moment you make peace, the next moment you make peace, the next moment you make peace with it, you will find, obviously, you will have peace. You're building up what we call the house of peace, the retreat center inside of you, made by many, many little stones, many little grains of cement, many pieces of metal, many bricks, many cables, many pipes, all coming together to make a retreat center. Many, many moments of peace coming up to build a house of peace. And that's how meditation works. When I make war, I don't want to feel tired. I don't want to feel restless. I don't want to ache. I make war with my body. I make war with my mind. I make war with you guys. I don't know why I teach meditation. I teach, and everyone just falls asleep. Everyone has the same old problems. How many times do I have to teach meditation? Oh, you guys are hopeless. Now that's called making war. Making peace. You're just human beings doing your best. You know, you get there in the end. Even though it may be after the time of Maitreya Buddha before you become enlightened. Little matter. When you make peace with things, then you have peace. And you can make peace with anything. Which is why when sometimes people used to come up to me and say, oh, I can't meditate. I said, what do you mean you can't meditate? Oh, I can't watch my breath. Well, that's not meditation, watching your breath. Oh, I can't have loving kindness. Maybe to some people, it's not my ex-husband. That's not. sort of meditation. Meditation is making peace with things. If you've got a painful memory of your past husband, if you've got a body which is falling apart, if you've got a mind which is just so tired and just wants to go to bed, or you're hungry because it's the first time you've ever kept 8 precepts, and you come to the evening meeting and you just, all you can ever think of is your favourite dish of noodles. You can actually visualise them steaming, you know, the aroma. You can see the pieces in the dish there. Oh. Make peace with that. It's just, oh, it's okay, it's just a mind playing around. You can always make peace with things, which means you can always meditate. And if you keep making peace, and you keep making peace, and you have faith in the law of karma, you're Buddhist, I hope. If you're not, I'll make peace with that. You make peace with your mind, you make peace with this moment. And you will find, because you have faith in that law of karma, there's going to be a result there. And that result is you're going to get more and more peaceful as this retreat goes on. Has to happen. If you're making peace, you're going to get peace. And that's what happens. People make peace with this moment, peace with the next moment, peace with the next moment. They keep on making peace all day. Not war, not trying to change things and control things. Making peace with all their 5 senses. Whatever you see, you might see sort of somebody sneaking some biscuits or their old packet noodles, and you can see them eating it at night time, wait till you all go to bed, and then they sort of get up and have a midnight snack even though they're not supposed to. Doesn't matter, make peace, that's their karma, it's nothing to do with you. And anyway, poor things, they must be hungry. So be compassionate to them. You can make peace with things. When you make peace with things like that, you do have peace. If you make war, what does it do to you? You know, you see someone misbehave, or, you know, break the rules, or, you know, find some way around keeping the rules. Sometimes it makes you really upset. Why are you allowing other people to make you upset for? That's their come. You make peace with things. Otherwise, if you go looking at what other people are doing and trying and worrying about those, you'll never find any peace. Well, Ajahn Chah used to say, he said, monks, you should only look at other people at the very, very, very maximum 5% of the time. Look at yourself 95% of the time. He said, that's the maximum 5%. You can do much less than that. So don't worry what other people are doing. That's their business. Your job is to look at your own mind and make peace with what you're doing. And then, eventually, you have peace. And as the meditation retreat rolls on, you find you get more and more calm. More and more still, and the meditation becomes more easy, simply because you've been making peace all day for several days, and you have this beautiful feeling of peace. And that's the same as the other intentions. We say making peace, another way of letting go. There's supposed to be 3 right intentions, you know, renunciation, letting go, making peace, I call it. Or I should actually mention, making peace also includes being patient. So sometimes we can't wait for lunch, any more minutes to go. Or sometimes we can't wait till the talk's over. How long is Ajahn Bum going to go on for? We haven't put a clock in this room on purpose. So this room is timeless room. Outside there are clocks, but not in here. Because when you start being a prisoner of time, then you get impatience. I don't know. Maybe already you've only started yesterday. How many more days left of the retreat? You only just started, and sometimes people start thinking, how many more days left? And sometimes, I remember when I was a school teacher, one of my fellow teachers, he just didn't like being a school teacher, and he got a job in the tax office. It's like what we call out of the frying pan into the fire. But nevertheless, he got a job in the tax office, and he had to finish his contract as a school teacher before he could go off and work for the tax office for a better salary. And he came up to me one day. I always remember what he said. He said, it was about 4 months until his contract was finished. He said, I just found myself wishing away 4 months of my life. said, 4 months of my life, that's a huge portion of my life I've just been wishing away so I can go and be somewhere else. You can't afford to wish away 4 months of your life. Many of you haven't got that many months left. You're already getting pretty old. It's true, you know. What is it, the average lifespan? 75, 80? So subtract your age from that, multiply by 12, and that's how many months you've got left. 4 months, how many percent is that? Not much. No, not much left, so 4 months is a big percentage. So actually wishing away so much of a chunk of your life is just ridiculous. And in fact, you can't even wish away 1 day of your life. Not even 1 minute of your life. It's precious. So when we learn not to wish away even a minute of our life, we understand how to be patient. Impatience is wishing away huge chunks of our time so we can be somewhere else in the future. Renunciation is also learning how to be patient and not rush off into somewhere in the distance, but learning how to be. Again, that's renouncing the controller. The controller always wants to keep you on the move. This idea of a controller, I used to think of the controller as my friend. This will would always make things happen for me. And if I tried hard enough, I'd pass my exams. If I really willed it, I could get the girl of my dreams. Ha ha ha, it never happened. Good job, otherwise I wouldn't have become a monk. If I willed hard enough, I could be successful. If I willed hard enough, I could get this retreat center finished. Ha 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 ha. It's nothing to do with your will. In fact, the more you will, the more frustrated you become, and eventually the more angry you become. Something I've noticed in our modern world. Competition is so strong, and our goals are so high. What we expect of ourselves is so high that we force ourselves so much that our willpower is much greater, I believe, than our ancestors. And because of that, that's why we get more frustrated than the people who went before us, and also more angry. Because when we will, when we try and control this world, we always come across barriers. Barriers where we can't get what we want. We can't make it the way we want. We can't just get it what it should be. And what many people do when they come across those barriers is they try and will even harder. Try and use more force. You know, try and use more skillful means sometimes to try and get what you want. But eventually, everyone who follows that path will come across a barrier which they cannot climb over. No matter how many times they beat their heads against that brick wall, it never breaks through. As someone once pointed out, what is stronger, bricks or human flesh and bone? Human flesh and bone is far weaker. So you're asking for trouble when you bash your head against a brick wall. You're not going to win. But people do that. And what happens is they just get frustrated. And when frustration comes to a particular point, it just goes into anger. As they take it out on their friends, their enemies, their loved ones, even on that stupid wall. Why are you like that? And that's not the way of Buddhism. All comes from, again, controlling. And all, in particular, from impatience. Our job, by letting go of controlling, is just to be here. Don't even think of the next moment. This moment now. And if you make peace and are very patient, then things come to you. You know you're doing the very best. This very interesting little observation, which I've been mentioning very often for the last year. What is impatience anyway? Looking for the future, thinking that something's going to happen soon. Like in that Beckett play, Waiting for Godot. waiting for jhana, waiting for enlightenment. Instead of actually waiting for things in the future, we do what we call waiting in the present, not waiting in the future. Waiting in the present is very different than waiting in the future. Waiting in the present moment is being here, waiting for the postman to deliver your letter now, rather than waiting for the postman to deliver the check this afternoon or tomorrow or next year. Waiting in the present is called patience. Waiting in the future is impatience. Please understand the difference there. And the observation which I was going to mention was, where is your future made? When is the only time you can actually do anything to create a peaceful, happy, kind future? You all know the answer. It's obvious when I put it that way. When you ask the right question, you get the good answers. When is your future made? Now. So if you really want to have good meditation, if you're coming on this retreat wanting to get jhanas or enlightenment, at least have a bit of peace in meditation, when's the only time you can do that? Now. So you make peace now. You be kind now. You be gentle now. And that's all you can do. Thinking of the future, when's it going to happen, when's it going to happen? You're not making peace, you're not being kind, you're not being gentle. And the other two, being kind and being gentle, that's the other two parts of right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Kindness, avayapada sankhapa, literally means non-ill will. But in Buddhism, when it's non-ill will, it's not sort of like a negative, it actually is the opposite state in this particular meaning. It's intentions of kindness. We all know what kindness means, but sometimes we practice it selectively. You can be kind to some people, maybe like your favourite monk, but you're not kind to other people like your husband, or like your kids, or like the workers you have. So the kind, and it's certainly, people can be kind to many beings, many sentient beings. But the one sentient being they're never really kind to is themselves. And so we have to be kind to ourselves. And it's not just being kind to our body, being kind to our mind. And what does kindness mean? And kindness means you accept that person for who they are. You accept that moment. If you've got a favourite cat or dog, are they a perfect cat? Are they a perfect dog? We've got this geriatric cat in our monastery, Kit Kat, who's now getting so old, sometimes we've caught it in the last couple of weeks, peeing in the dining room. It's just getting too old to actually to get outside to actually to urinate in a proper place. So there it is, urinating, sort of in the dining area. So what should we do? You stupid cat. No, you don't do that again. That's bad karma, cat. You can't do things like that. He said you'd be kind to the cat. The cat's just old, that's all. Just what old people do. Just what old cats do. What old dogs do. So what kindness? Just what old husbands do. Just what old wives are like. So what kids are like, what monks are like, what nuns are like. This is what we're like, that's all. So being kind is understanding people and just accepting them. And in that book, opening the door of your heart to that old cat. Oh, it's lived a long life. And, you know, give it some slack at the last years of its life. It can urinate wherever it wants. It's just a pain to actually to mop it up afterwards. But nevertheless, you can be kind to it. And if you be kind to a cat, can't you be kind to your old mind, who sometimes falls asleep in meditation? Right, just getting old, that's all. You're getting geriatric, your brain. So be kind to it. Oh, it doesn't mean you can be restless. Be kind to it. Whatever happens, be kind. Open the door of your heart. But more importantly, open the door of your heart to this moment. The door of my heart is open to this moment right now. No matter who you are, no matter what's happening, you have what we call unconditional mindfulness. Not loving kindness. Unconditional mindfulness. We can be mindful and embrace this moment, no matter what it is. So we don't have selective mindfulness. I only be mindful of this, but I don't want you to cough and spoil my mindfulness. We have unconditional mindfulness, being able to be aware of whatever happens in this moment with kindness. That's another way of making peace. Making love, not making battles. So when you open the door of your heart to any moment, you can always do that. Because you don't have to have certain conditions to have openness of mind. Which means you can, again, always meditate. So you're sleepy, so you're in pain, so you're dying. You can always open the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it happens to be. You may be cold, you may be hungry, you can always open the door of your mind to that moment, unconditionally, which means you can always meditate. And last of all, please be gentle. Because this mind is a very sensitive thing. It is like a flower, like a lotus, the Buddha said. And if you can crush a lotus so easily, once it's crushed and bruised, it takes a long time to heal. And if it's going to take a long time for you to meditate, the main reason is because you have bruised your mind. There's many scars in it. And it's not because of other people. It's because you haven't been gentle to yourself. You haven't cared for your own mind, let alone your body. So you have to give a chance for all those inner scars and those bruises to heal. And the only way to do that is this beautiful gentleness. Because I've been a monk for such a long time and a Buddhist many years before, you have like a feeling for what a Buddha is. And what is your conception, your feeling of a Buddha? It's not just this wise guy. It's this beautiful, peaceful, gentle, compassionate person. With all these powers, who would only use them so kindly and so gently, would never criticize anybody. It always was really strange whenever I started reading about the monk's code of discipline, the Vinaya. This was 2,500 years ago. And there was no punishments in there. You weren't beaten or sort of kicked or sort of hung upside down for 3 days if you broke a rule. There was no sort of torture or punishment there at all. This is incredible. Acknowledge your mistakes, forgive it, and learn from it. And that was really sort of threw me for a while because I never expected that. If a monk misbehaved, always expected some sort of punishment. Because maybe it's because I was brought up in a Christian tradition and heard all these monks whipping themselves or whipping each other, you know, and doing all these other ascetic things. I thought, you know, maybe that's what happens in a Buddhist monk. But no, it's not at all. It's so gentle. And even just in practice, that's what I read in the old suttas. When any monk made a mistake with Ajahn Chah, did something really stupid, he just burst out laughing. No, they're crazy. This guy is mad. You know, people do something absolutely stupid or break a precept, and you think it was so funny. But that was a beautiful teaching of how to be gentle. Because he was trusting us. You didn't need to be punished to know you've made a mistake. We all know we make mistakes. Sometimes the reason why we make mistakes is because we hate ourselves. We don't trust ourselves. We become too tense. That's why we make mistakes. But with the kindness, our virtue increases naturally. We don't need to make mistakes when we're kind to ourselves. And that's what I was taught. The beautiful gentleness of a Buddha. So when you're meditating, meditate like a Buddha. I'm not saying to have all these psychic powers and get the deepest of jhanas. I say meditate, letting go and making peace. the great peacemaker. Meditate with kindness. Open the door of your heart to every moment. Meditate with gentleness, the gentleness of a Buddha, holding a flower in the hand without crushing it or bruising it. Because you're going to be holding your mind in the palm of your hand for the next 8 or so days. Hold it gently. Don't crush it. Don't bruise it. It will take a while for those bruises to heal, which you've already incurred by being too tough on yourselves. And when they do heal, your beautiful lotus will be so pure and fragrant. That's your mind. So in this retreat, please remember what letting go truly is, what right intention is, what good meditation karma is, making peace, being patient, letting go, being kind, and being gentle. And do that in every moment, and you'll find you have the heart of meditation. And you'll find meditation isn't difficult. These are something you can always do. You might not be able to watch the breath. You may not always be clear in your mind. You can always make peace, be kind, be gentle and patient. You can always do that. And you keep doing that as much as you can in this retreat. You're making good meditation karma, and I guarantee you'll get the good results of that good meditation karma. A peaceful, blissful, energetic mind. And who knows? Even enlightenment. But be patient. Wait in the moment for it. Don't wait in the future. So that's the first talk of Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. And you were there to witness this historic moment. Oh, isn't this exciting? Okay. So happy meditation. I'm glad to see you smiling. And keep those smiles up. Now you have free time between now and 11 o'clock. If you are still tired, you have your individual rooms, and I guarantee there are no CCTV cameras hidden in the wall. I will not recall what you do in your rooms. So go in there if you're tired, have a rest. If you want a cup of tea, coffee, have a cup of tea, cup of coffee. Hopefully the water is coming this morning, and so you'll have showers, hot showers later on today. But if you haven't, just make peace with the smells. And remember, a dog would be happy to smell it. So have happy meditation. We'll see you later on today. Oh, very good. And again, usually we don't have any interviews the first day. Just let people just relax. And we have interviews starting tomorrow. Okay, so off you go. Happy meditating.